And you are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. It's difficult to overstate the importance of the Haitian Revolution, which began in 1791. In that year, black slaves toiling on the western side of the island of Hispaniola began a revolution that, unlike any other slave revolt in the Americas before or since, actually succeeded. They won emancipation, and a decade later, the residents of this French colony also won independence from France and proclaimed a new nation called Haiti. My guest today writes that by creating a society in which all people of all colors were granted freedom and citizenship, the Haitian Revolution forever transformed the world. My guest today is Laurent Dubois, who has written a highly acclaimed history of the Haitian Revolution entitled Avengers of the New World. Laurent Dubois is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. He joins us now by phone from his office in East Lansing. Welcome, Laurent.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us today. Let's start with Saint-Domingue, as this French colony was called, before the revolution began. You note that Saint-Domingue was the most profitable slave colony, not just in the Americas, but in the world. How did it attain this status?
Well, it's really a quite remarkable history, especially because it has a very short history, actually. The colony really takes off only in the early 18th century, and then it's really destroyed at the end of the 18th century. So it's a latecomer in the process of plantation slavery in the Americas. But it had an ecological advantage, a series of very large and often well-irrigated plains that allowed for it to become one of the major world producer of sugarcane, which requires both water and kind of flat land for effective production. But then in addition, a coffee plantation economy boomed there in the later 18th century. So the combination of these two crops together made it just a real powerhouse in the Atlantic economy. And most of its products were brought to France, and then a large amount of them were then re-exported throughout Europe to Germany and elsewhere. So the colony supplied many, many Europeans with coffee and sugar, two things which they were increasingly dependent on over the course of the 18th century.
And why was, as you write, slavery deemed essential to the production of especially sugar?
This was an incredibly labor-intensive crop. In fact, essentially, the investment in the slaves was really the most important investment that was made. It was incredibly grueling work. It took place a very, very hard process, especially during periods of harvest, which required an intensive work. Sugarcane stalks, if anyone's ever been around them, as you know, have sharp leaves on them and are very difficult to cut and so forth. There was a kind of round-the-clock process of processing that had to happen just as they were harvested, which required night shifts. This was really a highly industrial form of processing, but also a very brutal one. And for a variety of complicated reasons, Europeans decided that the best way, or what they thought was the best way to create these crops, was through slave labor. And they did it in a way that was really particularly brutal, in the sense that they essentially chose, rather than trying to lessen the death rates among slaves, which were huge, to simply buy more slaves when those that they had worked to death died. So it was a process that produced a lot for Europe, but consumed enormous numbers of people, obviously, through this horrific process of the slave trade and slavery itself.
Just before the Haitian Revolution began in 1791, the island, and we should say this is the western portion of the island called Saint-Domingue, the French colony, was majority slave. Perhaps 90% of its residents on the Revolution's Eve were slaves. What else do we need to know about who these slaves were and how they lived?
I guess a combination of things. One of the things that really makes Haiti particularly unique is that because of the brutality of the sugar plantation economy, the majority of the slaves were actually African-born. So many of these people were men and women who had, in fact, been raised in Africa, spoke African languages, practiced religions rooted in Africa, and so forth. And importantly, for the history of the revolution, an important number had been soldiers in Africa and brought military techniques with them across the Atlantic, as well as political perspectives and ideas. So that's one part, is that, you know, there, more than half of them had literally experienced being brought across the Atlantic, and they had memories of Africa and of course, of that journey. Their lives were varied, depending on where they lived and what plantations. The largest number, though, were field workers, whose life essentially consisted of being overseen doing field labor in the sugarcane or coffee fields. There were, however, slaves who were in charge of the plantation labor gangs who had a certain different kind of privileges, and of course urban domestic slaves, urban slaves, artisans. So there was a relatively variation among them as well, which would take shape during, which would affect the way that the revolution took shape in the subsequent years.
Now, not all the people of color in Saint-Domingue were enslaved. Tell us about the so-called free coloreds in that colony.
Now, this is another remarkable thing about the colony, is that a population base essentially as large as, perhaps even slightly larger than the white population, was made up of free people of African descent. They were sometimes of mixed European and African ancestry, and sometimes not. Some of them had been emancipated in their own lives, but many of them were actually generations of descendants of people who had been freed long before, or at least a generation or two before. And among them were a small but significant group of quite wealthy planters who themselves owned slaves. So these are people who were descended from slaves, but also owned often large numbers of slaves. They were most significant in indigo and coffee production, kind of the later or the smaller forms of plantation rather than sugar. But they had a very different perspective, obviously. They were, on the one hand, angry about and restricted by racist legislation that kind of put them outside the reach of certain rights and didn't allow them to follow certain professions, and they wanted to change that at the time of the revolution. But many also had a certain investment in maintaining slavery, so their relationship to the process of revolution was often complicated and ambiguous.
We're speaking with Laurent Dubois. He teaches history at Michigan State University, where he focuses on Latin America and Caribbean history. He's author of A Colony of Citizens, Revolution and Slave Emancipation in the French Caribbean, 1787 to 1804, as well as co-author of a new book with John Garrigus of the book Slave Revolution in the Caribbean, 1789 to 1804. That's A Brief History with Documents, just out from Bedford Press. The show is Against the Grain on KPFA. My name is C.S. Song. So before 1791, the imperial power, France, did something quite momentous, and many of us have heard about the French Revolution, and we're not going to talk in depth about that revolution, but I want to focus a little time on the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, adopted by the new National Assembly in France in 1789. Tell us about that document.
Well, it's really a fundamental document. I have actually here a copy on my wall that I always look at. It's different in some ways than the kinds of parallel documents we have in the U.S., and its difference is that it was not itself a constitution. It was meant to be the set of basic principles that all constitutions henceforth should be based upon. So it has a very kind of wide and broad and universal scope. It basically lays out the basic rights of humanity in a series of articles. And it's, you know, it begins with some of the basic rights that we think of. It had, in a certain sense, a kind of contradiction embedded in it that I point out in the book, which is that it had, on the one hand, it gave people all people the basic human rights to liberty and so forth. On the other hand, it also allowed for the defense of private property. And of course, in the colonies, that contradiction was going to be quite important, since many masters considered their right to their slaves a right to private property. So in a sense, the Declaration had its own contradiction. But I think its universal language, as a lot of commentators point out, always kind of exceeded the conditions in which it was articulated, in the sense that those who wrote it down probably didn't imagine that it assumed, or most of them anyway, didn't imagine that it necessarily implied that, for instance, slavery was unlawful, or that women should be granted rights and so forth. But nevertheless, people could take the document and run with it in certain ways, and they could draw on the document to make more radical claims than were necessarily made even by those who wrote it. It was written by essentially upper-class professional men who had been elected to this assembly. So it has a history in which it's kind of pushed to mean new things, and that's really what happened in the Caribbean.
And did the white planters, did the white elites in Saint-Domingue respond to this Declaration of the Rights of Man by seeing kind of the universal principles within it and saying, look, we need to start advocating for the abolition of slaves in our colony?
Well, no, absolutely not. I mean, they on the one hand, they recognized some of the principles, and they themselves had their own desires for, particularly for kind of more autonomy over their own internal affairs. Many of them saw the United States as a kind of model, because what they saw in the United States was that this had been a place where colonists had gotten more power for themselves, but also, in fact, preserved slavery in the process in most of their states. But they really quickly, however, really realized that this was a document was a problem, and there are quite quick efforts to kind of try to constrain its circulation and to actually limit its circulation among slaves, because I think they quite lucidly actually realized that for slaves this was going to be a pretty clear statement that in some sense the French government itself had described rights that they had, and that these rights contradicted directly the kind of oppression they experienced on a daily basis from their masters.
Laurent Dubois, author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, you mentioned a certain kind of perhaps dissatisfaction experienced by the white elites, the white planters on this island toward France, toward the colonial power. To what extent were they unhappy with the way France administered the island?
Well, they had mostly a set of economic grievances, which were also linked to political grievances. France administered the island, although this had been mitigated by the middle of the 18th century, through a pretty strict monopoly system in which the idea was that the colonies should produce things for France, for the mother country, and they should be shipped to France along certain routes, and the prices and so forth were therefore set by French merchants. And of course, many planters and many planters throughout the Caribbean, in fact, noticed that the United States, which was also a lucrative market, was much closer, and that probably more money could be made with other markets that were closer by. Many of them actually participated actively in essentially an illegal trade, and they had for a long time selling their goods. There's a really, really important trade that actually ties the development of New England into these slave colonies with the exchange of molasses from the Caribbean to make rum in New England, and then goods from New England to support the colonies, because these colonies never really could produce their own foodstuffs. They always needed to import it. But there was a desire essentially among planters to make more money, and indeed they did have some restrictions placed on them by the government that they chafed against. And in order to do that, they did take seriously the new ideas of democracy, the revolution, in the sense that they wanted to have more representation and assemblies of their own, and they indeed did create local assemblies during the early years of the revolution. But of course, their idea of what democracy was contrasted sharply with the idea by the free people of color as well as the slaves.
Let's move up to August 1791. Now, we have black slaves, a majority slave island. We have brutally treated for decades, for centuries. We have white planters, white slave owners who are somewhat dissatisfied with France, although it is certainly still a French colony. We have free coloreds who, as you said, some of them owned land, some of them didn't, some of them certainly had no problem with the institution of slavery. In August 1791, there was a mass insurrection staged by slaves in the northern plains of Saint-Domingue. And again, we're talking about an area that became Haiti about a decade later. What were the immediate causes of the decisions of slaves in this area to stage such an uprising?
That's a great question, and in a sense, one that we still haven't fully answered. As you can imagine, the slaves who organized their uprising didn't leave too many records of what they were doing, for obvious reasons that to do so would have been dangerous. But there are a number of forces that converge around there, and there's a series of processes. One is a long-standing resistance against slavery. That's, of course, a tradition in the colony and a tradition that had been present. I don't know if it had been growing, but it was certainly present throughout the decades. Involved in that were religious foundations, and those are quite important because we have a strong. Pretty well that around the time of the launch of the insurrection, an important ceremony took place, in which there was an oath taken and a set of agreements to kind of launch this revolution. There are also political meetings. I think overall, the slaves realized that a lot of things were afoot. They understood, for instance, that free people of color who had been, in fact, taking up arms to demand rights were weakening the system. They understood that the whites, in many cases, were in conflict with one another, and that had weakened the system. They had heard rumors that the King of France had plans to abolish slavery. Um, these were not true rumors, but they were, in a sense, rooted in the fact that there was activism going on in France, not so much by the king, but by others against slavery. So they had a sense that they might find allies outside, and they saw it as a moment to act, and they decided to take it in hand and transform their own destinies themselves. There's a specific context, which is that there was a meeting of the local assembly, which essentially brought together many of the leading planters in the colony, all in one place, in Le Cap, the week before they rose up. And historians suspect that there probably was a plan to actually try to take Le Cap and essentially wipe out that planter class in one sweep, which they did not succeed in doing. But that meeting might have been one particular trigger.
Did these slaves make any initial demands on the planters, on the elites in Saint-Domingue? Did they present a list of grievances and then say, look, if you don't comply, if you don't somehow meet these demands, we're going to stage this uprising?
They didn't. They didn't do anything like that. I mean, they essentially launched an uprising. It's important to know that essentially, you know, there had been many attempts at conspiracies before, and as in Saint-Domingue, throughout the Americas, any kind of hint of conspiracy, even just the suspicion of conspiracy, often led to quite brutal tortures of slaves, burnings, and so forth. There had been a kind of whole regime of suppression and torture. So the idea of actually speaking to the planters in some sense or presenting demands, I think, would have just seemed somewhat suicidal or dangerous. What they did instead was to set in motion a revolt that very, very quickly gained them control over much of the northern plain, terrorized their masters, sent those that survived fleeing into the major towns, and it gave them the higher ground. And once they had gotten the higher ground, there was a process through which they began to issue demands. But it was only, I think, reasonably enough from a position of strength, of military safety and strength, that they were going to do that.
There was enormous energy. There was enormous, the revolt spread very, very quickly over a fairly large part of the Saint-Domingue. Tell us about that. Tell us what these rebels, if you want to call them that, what they did to the countryside and what they did in relation to people they didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Well, they when they rose up, they quickly did a number of things. One is that they set things on fire. They started burning cane fields, the hated cane fields in which they'd work. They burnt the masters' houses. They often killed the masters and their families. There's also a fair number of cases in which either insurgents or slaves kind of helped their masters escape before joining the insurrection. So there's a kind of combination there, but certainly many were killed. And they also destroyed the machinery often of sugar plantation production. So they're really just basically wanted to wipe out, I think, the infrastructure of the sugar plantations in which they had been enslaved, and they did so quite quickly and quite effectively. They then, after a certain point, started taking prisoners as well, which they used ultimately to negotiate, then sort of set themselves in the process of transforming themselves into an army. It's important to note that this was a really varied movement. There was a leadership, but the leadership obviously had, I think, limited control over the first part of the insurrection. So the kinds of actions people took were in many ways somewhat autonomous, and people who had not necessarily been involved in the early plot joined in, at least some joined in, not everybody joined in. The organizers had been actually what were called drivers, or many of the organizers had been drivers, which were slaves who had a position of authority on the plantation and who actually kind of controlled other slaves. So they were able to kind of play a leadership role, and that mobilized a large number of slaves. But I think after that, they quickly realized, I think quite strategically, that first of all, they were going to need to be a solid armed force, and they needed to sort of organize themselves in that way to respond to French resistance, and also that they needed to start opening up lines of communication and starting to converse. I think they quickly understood that theirs was not going to a revolution that would win by itself, but it needed negotiation and perhaps allies.
And early on, maybe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, 2 or 3 months after the uprising, this insurrection began, there were negotiations, and the rebels did put forth a plan to end the insurrection. What did they demand, and how did those demands change over time?
Well, there's a really interesting process of the steady expansion of demands. The original set of demands, which were put forth in November, and this is actually shortly after this is a sign of, I think, the emergence of this leadership, is that an early insurgent leader named Jeannot, who was particularly brutal to his prisoners, to white prisoners, and kind of had, you know, reversed the whippings and killings that had gone on the plantations and had them carried out against whites, was actually executed by his superiors. And I think this was part of their bid to create openings for negotiation, just to realize that they needed to rein in the more brutal tactics in order to have an opening. But they proposed actually a plan by which a certain number of leaders would be given freedom, but that they would in turn help to bring the remaining insurgents back into the plantations. And they also, though, however, pushed for certain kinds of reforms in slavery. They criticized certain particular aspects of slavery. So it suggests that they, at that point anyway, at least the leadership, didn't necessarily see the possibility of demanding an outright abolition of slavery, which, it must be said, was not imagined by that many people at that time either. They did note, however, in their letters of the time, that there was a solid group of people in the camps who had a much more radical agenda, and I think the leaders, in a sense, were propelled steadily on by those who followed them to push things a little further. In that particular set of negotiations, the colonists weren't really willing to budge at all, and they essentially refused to negotiate, and that kind of ended that. And over the course of the following months, you get an increasingly radical set of demands that ultimately actually begins in 1792 to be a demand for full liberty in certain quarters.
Laurent Dubois, he joins us by phone from his office in East Lansing at Michigan State University, where he is an associate professor of history. We're talking about his book, Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, published by Harvard University Press. We have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. There had been rumors, Laurent, since the beginning of the revolution, rumors of imminent emancipation of Saint-Domingue's slaves. What happened in Saint-Domingue by decree in 1793, first in the north and then in the south?
Well, over the course of 1793, the insurrection kept gaining force, and it was never suppressed. But in early 1793, both France went to war with both Britain and Spain. Spain, of course, controlled the other half of the island that Saint-Domingue was on, and Britain was nearby Jamaica and had quite powerful navy. And both of them really wanted to get their hands on Saint-Domingue. So suddenly, the French hold on the colony seemed extremely fragile. Many planters were, in fact, suggesting that an alliance with England might be a good idea because they could help better preserve slavery that way than with the French. So a series of commissioners who had been sent from France and who are really interesting figures, the most important probably Léger Félicité Sontonax is his name, did something completely bold that they really had no instructions to do, which is over the course of 1793 they started inviting slave insurgents to join the Republican side to defend the island against the Spanish and the British, and in return they would give them freedom. This began as an individual offer for those particular people who joined the army, but over the course of 1793 it became clear that they weren't going to gain too many supporters unless they did something more radical. And so in August they declared that slavery was abolished throughout Saint-Domingue. It began in August and went over, took a few months to be applied everywhere. And they offered not only liberty but actually citizenship to the ex-slaves, and this is really a phenomenally radical move. I would say that at the time, even the more radical abolitionists in Europe, none of them would have advocated this kind of move to grant an immediate liberty and citizenship. So it really is the creation of the on-the-ground revolution in Saint-Domingue and the demands of the slaves in relationship to these Republican commissioners, and something that really pushes the political possibilities in the Atlantic very, very fast forward in a certain way.
It's one thing for a colony of colonial power like France to sort of unilaterally declare that all slaves are emancipated and are now citizens. I guess it's another thing for the imperial power to actually say, yes, we agree. And so what did the National Convention in France do early next year, that was 1794, upon hearing about these emancipation decrees in Saint-Domingue the year before?
Mm-hmm. It's fundamental. And when obviously the National Convention in early 1794 was a particularly radical group, and other parliaments may well have done something different. But there was an election after this emancipation in Saint-Domingue, and it ended up sending several delegates across the Atlantic to go to Paris to explain what had happened. I always tell the story of one among them who was a man named Jean-Baptiste Bellay, and who was actually African-born and had himself survived the Middle Passage, and was going back across the Atlantic now as a representative to the French Parliament. It's quite a change, obviously.
Indeed.
Symbolizes the kind of radical possibilities at that time. He and his colleagues went to Paris after various adventures, and they stopped in Philadelphia, where they were harassed notably by other Saint-Domingue exiles. But they went into Paris and they essentially explained what had happened, and they declared quite powerfully not only that ideologically it was right to abolish slavery, but that strategically it was also the smartest move for France, because it had effectively saved Saint-Domingue, they declared, from the English and the French, from the English and the Spanish, excuse me. And so the National Convention, I think, for both ideological and pragmatic reasons, a mix, realized that this was indeed a good policy. But they then took a next radical step, which was to expand it to the entire French Empire, so that it became the law not only of Saint-Domingue, but of the French Republic in its entirety. And in doing so, what they were really doing is also making a radical break with decades of colonial administration, because what they basically had declared was that if there were laws in metropolitan France, they had to be the same across the empire, effectively, that it didn't make sense to have laws only to some and denied to others. So there's a real kind of legal and juridical precedent there that was quite significant.
So, Laurent, is it too strong to say that because of the slaves rising up in Saint-Domingue and then, of course, leading to the emancipation decrees on the island, that without that, France might not have at that time decreed emancipation for all of the French colonies?
I think it's doubtlessly true. I mean, I think it would have been very, very feasible if there had not been the revolt in Saint-Domingue. Just from what we know of the debates that did go on in France before that revolt, it's quite clear that there wasn't really a strong enough will to abolish slavery. And I think what you would have had is a case like in the United States, essentially, where although there were some contestation, ultimately France would have simply maintained slavery in its colonies. Really, the slave revolution in the Caribbean is the central event that changes everything in that respect.
Laurent Dubois, Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University, author of A Colony of Citizens that won several awards, I believe, the book Slave Revolution in the Caribbean, 1789 to 1804, out recently. It's a brief history with documents, and the book we're talking about today, Avengers of the New World, the story of the Haitian Revolution. Links to all that good stuff on our website, againstthegrain.org. We'll take a short music break and then be back with Laurent to talk about, a lot of things. The legendary leader Toussaint Louverture, who you may have heard about, what he tried to do with Saint-Domingue, what Napoleon Bonaparte had, what his designs, he took power in 1799, I believe, in France, what he wanted to do with that island, and what the legacy, the history, the sort of what the story of the Haitian Revolution has meant to people, individuals, nations, groups around the world in the centuries since 1790. Stay with us.